everybody. We'll start as usual, visualizing in the space in front our objects of refuge and ourselves surrounded by all the sentient beings. And we'll be leading them in taking refuge and generating bodhicitta. And really think, you know, wow, one day these people that I have so much trouble with, you know, could actually do that. Yeah. Just as before we met the Dharma, maybe other people thought that same thing about us. Gee, these ignorant, obnoxious beings could one day meet the Dharma. Yeah. You think nobody thinks you're ignorant and obnoxious? No, okay, you're perfect, we know. Oh, you know they do. Okay, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, why do we always think that, you know, we're immune from those terms? Yeah. But you know, in some people's world, the way we act is ignorant and obnoxious. Isn't it? Yeah. Sometimes our parents may even use those words to describe us, especially when we're teenagers, or even when we're 3 years old, or when we're three-year-old teenagers, or three-year-old, 40-year-olds. Yeah. Okay. So I think it's very helpful to realize that people are not some kind of inherently existent personality, that they've always been that way and they always will be that way. Yeah, because we still have this idea that, you know, from one life to the next, that there's a fixed personality that just kind of picks up and transfers over. And when you really do some research on it, you find that's not exactly how it works. Like, I've never met the 13th Dalai Lama, but I've heard stories about him. And he apparently could be quite stern. He was far thinking, you know, in the future, like the present Dalai Lama, but he was much sterner as a person, not kind of as warm and jovial. You know, whereas the 14th Dalai Lama generally is quite warm and receptive. But you can also see sometimes when he really wants to get your attention, he's not. Okay. But you can see there's very different personalities from one life to the next. So, you know, if that happens in the realized beings, and certainly that's going to happen amongst us, where we have very little control or intention in the whole thing. Okay, so good to have a more open mind, expansive mind of other people's potential, and even of our own potential. Okay, so do the visualization. I think by now people should know what it is, and so describe it to yourself so that you will have the feeling of being in the presence of all these holy beings and of all the sentient beings. And then think that the bodhicitta is so precious. Are you willing to give your body to the Buddha in order to obtain the bodhicitta? And think of dedicating your body dedicating your life to the Buddha, completely giving it. So that you will live according to the Buddha's instructions, the Buddha's precepts, the Buddha's recommendations. Think if you're willing to do that because you value bodhicitta that much. And if you do, then mentally just give your body, give your life to the Buddha in that way. And then think, in return for dedicating your life and body to the three jewels, then the bodhicitta will grow easily in your mind. And so generate that thought. So did your mind feel okay about giving your body and giving your life to the Buddha? Or did one part of your mind say, I'm not so sure? Yeah. What is giving my life and my mind to the Buddha? Does that mean that I do whatever the Buddha says and I just become an extremely obedient person and wait for the Buddha to tell me what to do, and is that what it means? Yeah. What does giving our life to the Buddha mean? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot to think about here, you know? Because our initial response could be, yes, surrender. I surrender everything. And I just wait for the Buddha to tell me what to do, or I just follow the teachings and like that. Another word implied in this is I don't really think for myself. I just do what I'm told. Okay. Now, when it comes to some of our very deep afflictions that we are incredibly attached to, it can be very helpful for us sometimes just to surrender, so to speak, and let go of that affliction and follow what the teachings say. On the other hand, does the Buddha really want us to become automatons, yeah, who just, what's the word, like pawns, who just, you know, salute and say, yes, sir, I won't think about anything. And what does that mean for us as nuns? In a Buddhist institution where, according to the 8 Garu Dharmas, we're not allowed to even point out the mistake of a bhikshu, let alone the Buddha. You know, does the Buddha have mistakes? Okay, so what does all this mean? So this is something I think we really have to think about. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What does the path to Buddhahood look like? Do we just, finally be obedient, good little girls? Or big, good, little, big girls, yeah? Is that what it means? We're always polite, we always behave nicely. We never point anything out to anybody because that might offend them. Yeah. In one way, that's certainly better than having a big mouth and going around criticizing everybody, isn't it? Yeah, isn't it? Just learning to keep our mouth closed and not have so many opinions about every single thing, so that we have to comment on every single thing and point out every single thing people do, that you're breaking the precepts doing this and you're breaking the precepts doing that and you're so rude and you're so inconsiderate. Yeah. So in one way, you know, learning to keep our mouth shut and follow instructions can have some value, don't you think? I'm talking for us personally on the path, it can be very valuable. Yeah. In other situations, is it always valuable to keep our mouth closed and just follow along and not think so much? It's not valuable. But how do you tell one situation from the other? Yeah? How do you tell when it's valuable and when it's not? Well, one has to do with, the basic line is being aware of what is a virtuous motivation and what's a non-virtuous motivation. And that's the criteria there to decide between these two situations. But often, we don't know if our motivation is virtuous or non-virtuous. Do we? Yeah? Sometimes it's like, you know, I'm sure I have a good motivation saying this. And then we realize a week, a month, a year, 10 years later, no, we had a rotten motivation. So do you never chance it? Yeah? And always assume you have a bad motivation? Or do you become a little bit too inflated and always assume you have a good motivation? Yeah. These are not easy questions, are they? Are they? Yeah. And especially because even in the Buddha's advice, you know, on one hand, it's like, these are virtuous actions, do them. These are non-virtuous actions. For your own benefit, don't do them. Yeah. On the other hand, we hear, the Buddha said, don't accept everything I say. Question it, investigate it. So which one am I supposed to do? Yeah. So, you know, this is where wisdom comes in, and the wisdom to really discern within our own mind stream what is going on. Yeah. And to also admit when we don't quite know what's going on in our own mind, and when we aren't sure of our motivation. And so, you know, which way do we go? Or do we go ask somebody to help us clarify our motivation? Can we look to other teachings that the Buddha gave that could help us clarify what our motivation is and what constitutes benefit and what doesn't? Yeah. Or do we just sit there and go, blah, 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 blah. I don't know what to do. Let's go watch a movie instead. Okay, so think about these kinds of things, okay? And check up also, what is our idea of giving our body and life to the Buddha? What does that mean to us as an individual? Because there could be a variety of meanings to that, doesn't it? Couldn't there be? So does it mean I follow the Buddha's instructions when I want to, and I don't when I don't? So it's better than nothing. At least sometimes I'm giving my body and life to the Buddha. That's better than nothing. And I give my body and life to the Buddha when it's something that makes me happy. So at least that's the happiness of one sentient being. Yeah. It's better than being totally obnoxious. Is that what it means? So we're on verse 11, right? Before we do verse 11, because in Gyaltsebje's commentary, I don't know if this is what Gyaltsebje wrote or if it's what Fyodor, the translator, added. But anyway, it's very helpful. Asanga explained 5 types of conscientiousness. Okay, so the first one is relating to the past. So correcting our past actions according to the Dharma. So being able to look into how we've behaved in the past and, you know, somewhat accurately assess what our motivations were, what the how we did the deeds were, you know, if our deeds had all 4 parts complete in either becoming a virtuous propelling karma or all 4 parts incomplete. Or becoming complete in terms of being a non-virtuous karma. Okay, so correcting the ones where our motivation was kind of rotten, or maybe not kind of rotten, but definitely rotten. Are there degrees of rottenness, or is your motivation just rotten or not rotten? Yeah. Yeah, is your motivation either self-centered or not self-centered? Or are there degrees of self-centeredness? So you can have 2 degrees of self-centeredness and not be self-centered. Out of 4 degrees of self-centeredness, we have 2, so I'm not self-centered. Okay, so first one, correcting our conscientiousness relating to the past, correcting our past actions according to the Dharma. Then conscientiousness relating to the future, so determining to act in accordance with the Dharma in the future. So these 2 correspond with two of the four opponent powers. The conscientiousness in the past is corresponding with reviewing our past deeds and regretting things that need to be regretting. You know, that's the first of the four powers. The second kind of conscientiousness relates to the power of not making a determination not to do that action again. Okay, you see the correspondence there? Then the third one is preparatory conscientiousness, adjusting one's mind thinking. If I continue to act this way, then it is unsuitable. But if I engage in these actions, then it is appropriate. So that's a way of you learn from the past. You're not quite ready to make determinations about the future, but you prepare yourself. I skipped one, actually. That doesn't matter. I'll go back to it. We'll stay with the preparatory consciousness. So this one is the one that helps us go from regretting the past to determining right now, you know, what is suitable, what is unsuitable to do, and then being that leads us to be conscientious in the future. Okay. The third one, if we go back, was a conscientiousness in relationship to the present, which is determining to act in accordance with the Dharma without forgetfulness in the presence. So this is also a strong determination to act in the present. Of course, the present moment is pretty difficult to find. So it's much easier to know the past and the future. So here, present means sometime around the immediate future, okay? If we're making a determination to act in accordance with the Dharma without forgetfulness in the present, it can't refer to anything we've done in the past. It has to be something that we're about to do right now. So keeping conscientiousness in mind as we approach our actions. And the preparatory conscientiousness helps us to do that. And then the fifth one, the immediately following conscientiousness, is independent upon the above, abiding in virtuous actions. Okay, so we make a strong, we've purified from the past, we make a strong determination for the future, we're trying to be very present in a conscientious way in the present, we're preparing our mind to do that, and then we carry it out. Yeah. Okay, so those are the five types of conscientiousness. So if we go back to verse 11, okay, here we're talking about the disadvantages of abandoning bodhicitta. Remember last time we talked about Shariputra and his big no-no? Yeah, and how that's being a mystery in terms of how that karma worked out. But and then Shantideva proceeded to tell us more and more of the actual disadvantages of taking the bodhisattva ethical restraints, making that promise to really work for the benefit of sentient beings, and then dropping it and saying, you know, forget it. Yeah. So abandoning bodhicitta means that you really give it up. It isn't just one moment of being self-centered. It's giving up that whole aspiration. So we can do it in several ways. One way is if we leave even one sentient being out of our field of bodhicitta. So if you If we have the idea, yes, I want to work for the benefit of all sentient beings and become a Buddha to do so, and that's really my calling, but there's this one sentient being who has hurt me so much and is so foul and despicable that there's no way I want to work for their benefit. So if we have that kind of thought about one being, you know, that we're just completely, yes, I have bodhicitta for other sentient beings, but not for this one. He can rot in hell for all I care. Okay? So that kind of thought about somebody is relinquishing bodhicitta. Okay? Because bodhicitta depends on having the bodhicitta aspiration in relationship to every single sentient being, omitting none. Okay. Other ways of abandoning bodhicitta, and you can see that was Shariputra's problem. Remember, he cut off his right hand and handed it to the demon with his left hand, and that's considered like very bad manners in ancient India. So he just thought, okay, that sentient being, forget it. You know, I gave him what he wanted, and then he threw it down in the mud after I sacrificed my hand to give to him in an act of charity. You know, this guy is so picky. Yeah, how am I supposed to give my right hand in anything other than my left hand? This guy's so picky and so demanding. No way I can lead him to enlightenment. Forget him. Okay. So that's how it happened for Shariputra. And you can see it's not always that difficult to have that attitude towards somebody. When we get really furiously angry, do you ever get really furiously, totally out of control, enraged? Maybe not so often, but have you? Yeah? Where afterwards you look back at and you go, oh, what in the world happened to me? Yeah? So that's the time that happens, yeah? Or another way it could happen is we just decide, you know, it's just too hard. You know, working for the benefit of sentient beings, keeping all these bodhisattva precepts, it's just too hard. Why can't I become an arhat? That helps sentient beings too. Then there's one less obnoxious, you know, person if I become an arhat. So that benefits sentient beings. And also, I mean, three countless great eons, it just is too long. An arhat? Some people say I can become an arhat in three lifetimes once I become a stream enter. Some people say seven lifetimes. Some people say I can become an arhat and even in a stream enter and even in that same life become an arhat. Whoa, that's a lot shorter than this whole bodhisattva trip. Yeah, and who wants to remain in samsara longer than you have to? Because samsara is really a hellhole. So let's get myself out of there. And then after I get myself out, then I can think about helping sentient beings. Yeah, but I gotta help myself first. Makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah. So you see, not that easy, not that difficult to give up bodhicitta. We can give ourselves all sorts of quote logical arguments that sound very good in the moment. You know, and that's a very good example when we are not aware of what is a good motivation and what's not a bad, and what's a bad motivation. We simply are not aware. We're out to lunch. And we think, yeah, that's quite reasonable.
I wondered about the story with Shariputra, because he's entered the path, the Mayana path. He's, you know, minimum path of accumulation. Mm-hmm. And it's like the I mean, for me, it works more of, I'm wondering if it's correct, but it works more like the straw that broke the camel's back. Like there was so much that had happened. And then when it came to this demon, mm-hmm. he was happy to cut off his hand.
Mm-hmm.
The bodhicitta was there.
Yeah.
And then with the response, to me, it sounded like, you know, there was so much had happened. Mm-hmm. The resource is not there to get over this obstacle.
Yeah.
And that makes more sense than one incident of this obnoxious sentient being it's just kind of wonder, you know, what he had to go through to get to that point
uh-huh.
where he's giving up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, giving his hand is quite an act of charity. Yeah. But then something flipped in his mind. Yeah. So we could see it as the straw that broke the camel's back. Yeah, but we don't actually know how he was saying it in his mind. He may have been just saying it like I did, you know, like this sentient being's hopeless. So we don't know for sure. Either way, yeah, what the end result was is he relinquished the bodhicitta. Mm-hmm.
I still find that logic very convincing, the logic you just laid out. And especially, there's another one that says, it's so risky to stay in samsara. You don't know what kind of karma is going to ripen.
Mm-hmm.
You better get out. How are you going to help anybody if you're still stuck in samsara? And it seems airtight, actually, the logic.
Seems very good, doesn't it? Yeah, totally reasonable. Now, my question is, if all the people who are Buddhas and Bodhisattvas now thought like that, and they all became arhats, how would our situation be different? Would our situation be the same? No, the Buddha wouldn't have appeared in the world and taught the Dharma. He'd be in his own parinirvana. Yeah. If the Buddhas don't appear and teach the Dharma, how do we learn the Dharma? How do we practice the path? If we can't practice the path, how do we even protect ourselves from taking a lower rebirth? You know, we're really stuck. If all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas followed that logic, yeah, all the rest of us would be completely, you know, continual lower rebirths would just be what we had to look forward to. Okay. When you think like that, can you actually with a good conscience just say, my own liberation is more important? Yeah. When we've really thought about how interconnected we are with other living beings and their kindness and really how our life totally depends on them, then there's something in us where we cannot square that with our own internal values of what we know is right and wrong, can we? There may be all this convincing logic to get ourselves out of samsara and forget everybody else. But in our own heart of hearts, can we do that? Yeah? And leave everybody else behind? Difficult, isn't it? Really difficult. Yeah. So there we see, there we see that we definitely have some great compassion in our mind, even though we may see ourselves as very selfish. Yeah. At the bottom, there's that. We can't just walk away on others. Mm-hmm. Okay, So verse 11 says, thus, those with the heavy downfall and with strong bodhicitta, should they further circle in cyclic existence, shall be far from attaining a ground. Let's have this translation. Thus, those who have the force of the bodhicitta, as well as the force of falling from it. So somebody who has bodhicitta, but they've also abandoned it, and maybe they cultivated it afterwards again, or maybe not. But those beings will stay revolving within cyclic existence, and for a long time will be hindered from reaching the bodhisattva path, or bodhisattva grounds. Okay? So if you have bodhicitta and you give it up, yeah, it's going to be a long time before you get to the bodhisattva grounds. And even if you generate it again, you have to purify all that negativity of abandoning it. So that will delay reaching the bodhisattva grounds too. And when you study the bodhisattva grounds, read volume 6. Mm-hmm. It's coming out in, I think, May. Yeah. Then it talks about some of the qualities of the bodhisattva vows, just even briefly. But when you read about them, it is so amazing and so inspiring. It's like, wow, I want to be able to do that. Yeah, I want to be able to be of that kind of benefit. So then the next session is being conscientious in the trainings. So first thing we have to do is being conscientious in avoiding faults. Really? I have to be conscientious about that? Can't I just ignore my faults and call that being conscientious? So verse 12 says, therefore, just as I have promised, I shall respectfully accord my actions. If from now on I make no effort, I shall descend to lower and lower states. So here, we've taken on the engaged bodhicitta and the bodhisattva ethical restraints, and now we're saying, just as I've promised, I will respectfully accord my actions. So I said I was going to do this. My word means a lot to me. I don't give my word on something cheaply and easily. I give it after really investigating and thinking well. And when I give my word on something, when I promise something, I'm going to do it. Okay. That's the kind of person you can really trust, isn't it? Yeah. Rather than when a person who just says, oh, that sounds good. Yeah, I'll do it. And then later says, I bit off more than I can chew. I don't have time. I don't feel like it. Yeah. I mean, that kind of person who's, you know their word counts for very little. How much do you trust that person? Yeah. Whereas other people, you know, when they say something, they mean it, they'll do it. And then, yeah, then there's real trustworthiness that comes, yeah, isn't there? So this is how to make ourselves into a trustworthy person. We usually think, how do we learn to trust other people? Yeah, we usually put it outside. Who shall I trust? Who is trustworthy? But it's also very important to say, how do I become a trustworthy person? If I value trustworthiness, it's a quality I should try and develop in my own heart. How do I do that? Yeah. And, and we've all had the experience of some people trusting us and other people not trusting us. It's a weird experience, isn't it, when people don't trust us and we want to help, but they don't trust us. Yeah. So it's not just an issue of us wanting to help that's important. It's we have to make ourselves into a trustworthy person. So how do we do that? What are qualities of a trustworthy person? So this is something to have a discussion group about. Yeah, mark it down. And, yeah, on one Thursday morning when I'm not going to be here, then, you know, somebody make up the questions and have a discussion group about how to make ourselves into a trustworthy person, what we need to do and be. You can start that out by thinking about what qualities you see in other people that make them trustworthy, and then turning that around and saying, to what degree do I have those qualities and how can I grow those qualities in myself? Okay. So that's what this person's saying in the first two lines. In the second two lines, if from now on I make no effort, I shall descend to lower and lower states. So from now on, if I just abandon conscientiousness and don't make any effort to accord my actions to what I've promised I do, is that going to bring a good result? Yeah. I mean, for sure, other people won't trust me and they'll be disappointed. But what about karmically? What am I doing to myself when I promise to do something as magnificent as, you know, promising to lead all beings to awakening? And then I drop it because I don't feel like it anymore. Yeah, what am I doing to myself karmically when I make a promise to all sentient beings and then renege on that promise? Okay, so just as last week, you know, Shantideva gave the example of if we have the idea to give something to someone and in our mind we're going to give them something and then we don't give it, we change our mind, how that can lead to a rebirth as a hungry ghost. And that's a small event, isn't it? You know, oh, I was going to give you a box of, you know, of cookies, and then I decided to eat them myself. You know, and then that ripens as, you know, being born as a hungry ghost. And you can see why, because, yeah, we're denying somebody food, especially something they really like. Yeah, so karmically that's bad for us. But compare that action with promising sentient beings that you're going to work for their ultimate liberation and awakening and then reneging on that promise. Is anything good going to come from that? Forget it. You know, as he said here, I shall descend to lower and lower states. So, you know, constantly falling into the unfortunate realms and not just staying there and not just, you know, living in one unfortunate realm for, you know, however long that karma lasts. But once we fall to the lower realms, it's extremely difficult to get out. Yeah, because because it's very difficult to create any virtue in the lower realms. So you kind of have to rely on the virtue that you created as a human being before you created all the negativity that led you to an unfortunate realm now. Yeah. Otherwise, if you're born like an animal, then you got to hope that, you know, maybe people bring you into some teachings and you can hear the teachings while you fight with the other cats or sleep with them. But then they stop even doing that because they have the teachings in a different building and you don't get any karmic imprint. Yeah? Or maybe the person who takes you around, takes you for a walk, helps you to create some virtue by walking around, you know, the stupa in the garden. Yeah, maybe that person helps you that way. as much as you try and run in the opposite direction or go somewhere else. You want to go to the catnip. You don't want to go around the Buddha, but somebody helps you go around the Buddha and, you know, plant some good seeds in your mind. But you see, other than that, you know, that kind of situation, which is pretty rare, you know, very difficult to create good karma in once you're born in a lower realm. It's not impossible, but difficult. Okay, verse 13. Although for the benefit of every creature, countless Buddhas have passed by, I was not an object of their care because of my own mistakes. Okay, so here we are. We're trying to wiggle our way out of, you know, we have this fantastic logical argument, like she said, yeah, and we're trying to justify that argument, you know, and say, it doesn't really matter if I abandon bodhicitta. It doesn't matter, you know. I'll do that. I'll generate it again in another lifetime. Just, you know, not now. Just leave me alone, okay? But then we think that, you know, for the benefit of every creature, countless Buddhas have manifested in this universe, in other universes, yeah? Were we born as their disciples? Even Shakyamuni Buddha, whose teachings we follow in this lifetime, were we born as his disciple? No, who knows what realm we were in then? Yeah, we didn't have the fortune to know the Buddha directly. So if we get born in the lower realms or in human rebirth with so many limitations, then we're not going to be an object of the Buddha's care, not because the Buddha lacks compassion, but because of our own mistakes and we've created the cause to be born somewhere else. Yeah? So a good possibility, huh? There was the Buddha, you know, giving his first teaching at Sarnath, and maybe we were in the hungry ghost realm somewhere, or animal realm in some other universe, or maybe we were, you know, in the formless realm, blissed out in our samadhi. Didn't get us anywhere. Okay, verse 14. And if I continue to act like this, again and again shall I undergo suffering in unhappy realms, sickness, bondage, laceration, and the shedding of blood. Okay, so because of my own non-virtue, I haven't been born as a direct disciple of the Buddha. And if I continue to act in the same way, I'm going to get the similar result in the future, you know, together with, you know, sickness, bondage, laceration, and the shedding of blood. Who wants that kind of rebirth? Yeah, being born in a war-torn country, being born even as a human being, but you are drafted into a militia or an armed force and you don't want to go, but there's incredible pressure and you could get arrested by the government or you could get killed by a rebel group if you don't join the militia and, you know, attack other people. Who wants to be in that kind of situation? Not me. Okay. So verse 15 goes to talk about a precious human life and how the freedoms and fortunes that we experience in it are very rare. Yeah. So before it was about pertaining to the disadvantages of the lower realms and how easily that could befall us. Not because anybody's punishing us. Nobody's punishing us. It's because we create the cause. Here it's going into the benefits of having a good rebirth. Okay. So Shantideva says, if the arising of the Tathagata, faith, the attainment of a human body, and my being fit to cultivate virtue are scarce, when will they be won again? So when will I get these benefits? So those four things, okay, that he mentions right there are, remember in the dedication prayers for the Guru Puja, it talks about the four Mahayana wheels. Have you ever wondered what the four Mahayana wheels are? Yeah, you don't find it very much explained in too many texts, but here it's explained. Okay, so there are different names for them, or you know, the meanings I think come the same, but the names can be different. Okay, so here, arising of a Tathagata, faith in the Buddha Dharma Sangha, faith in the trainings and so on. The attainment of a human body with the freedoms and fortunes it gives us to practice. And our being fit to cultivate virtue. Yeah? So our being fit mentally to cultivate virtue, our being fit physically. Yeah? Because we have to have a healthy body to really practice deeply. We definitely have to have a healthy mind. Yeah, if we have a lot of mental impediments, it's going to be difficult to practice. Okay, so those are the four as they're in the verse there. In as I've heard, found them described in another text, which I forget what it was. It is first abiding in a conducive place. Second, under the guidance of a Mahayana spiritual mentor. Third, having great aspiration for the Mahayana and joyfully practicing it. And fourth, having an upper rebirth and great merit accumulated from the past. So that way of describing it, it's emphasizing more the Mahayana path than just how the translation is here. Okay, here he says, the coming of a Tathagata, faith and the attainment of a human body, these making it possible to meditate on virtue. Since they are rare, when will they be attained? Okay, so you could kind of take these two sets of four and put them together. You can see how they fit together. Okay, but if... Okay, so abiding in a conducive place. Yeah, so a place where the Tathagatas have appeared, where the Dharma exists, where there's the Sangha, yeah, having access to the teachings, being under the care of a Mahayana spiritual mentor. Yeah, so we may be in a place where the Buddha's teachings exist, but maybe we don't meet a Mahayana spiritual mentor. Yeah. They often talk about, everybody has the Buddha nature, but there are different kind of disciples somebody could be a different kind of disciple at different times. And somebody can have the disposition to right away go into the Mahayana. Others may have the disposition to right away go into the fundamental vehicle. And others may have the disposition to go into either, depending on the teacher that they meet. Yeah? So what happens if you have that last disposition and then you meet a fundamental vehicle master who says, you know, Mahayana teachings aren't really the word of the Buddha, just don't pay attention to them. Yeah. Or what happens if you have the Mahayana disposition, but you don't meet a teacher who does, and still you have faith in that teacher, then you also have problems. Okay? So being under the guidance of a Mahayana spiritual mentor. So that means not just meeting a teacher, but it means forming a student-teacher relationship with that person, hearing teachings from them, following the instructions in the teachings, okay, dedicating your life to that way of practice. Okay, then the third is great aspiration for the Mahayana. So you just, when you hear Mahayana teachings, you feel inspired, you want to do that. Yeah? And so you joyfully practice it. Now, some people, like, I feel greatly inspired by the Mahayana ideal. Joyfully practicing it, I could use some more joyous effort, you know? It's like, if I really have to tame my mind about some of these things where I'm stuck, that just is so hard, you know? And it's like worse than pulling teeth. Yeah. So, okay, so I need to generate some more joyous effort. How do you generate joyous effort in that situation? What do you do? Anybody else suffer from laziness? Yeah? What do you do when there's your laziness right in front of you? You love the Mahayana teachings, but you really love your own version of chocolate too. Yeah? And, you know, you really are the one who has the best idea about what the schedule should be and how to organize everything in the monastery. And when you really know, sincerely, you know from your heart how all your family members should live and what they should practice and what they should do. And we're so sincerely in your heart. You have some wonderful advice to give the U.S. government, especially the Prez. Yeah? What do you do when you firmly believe that? Yeah? What do you do?
So in some situations, not all, but in some situations, I use the suffering of change to help me kickstart my practice. Like, okay, let's see how many days you can go without practicing before your mind becomes a total mess. And so I let it ride. And then when I arrive at that point where my mind's a total mess, I say, okay, yeah, this is the reason why we need to do what we need to do. And then it's sort of like, all right, let's do it.
Okay, so you let yourself get fully immersed in the cesspool before you decide to get yes. out of it.
Yes, exactly.
So even, you know, just stepping into the cesspool a little bit.
Well, sometimes that works. Sometimes that works. Sometimes that doesn't. Depends on how stubborn my mind has become. Yeah.
Sometimes you let yourself get completely covered in filth before you decide to crawl out. Huh? Okay, what do you do?
I just remind myself about the frailty of life and that at any time I can drop dead. And so these moments are very precious. What am I doing? Mm. And that wakes me up again.
Yeah. What do you do?
Check in with my mind, and maybe I have too high expectations of myself. And then if I even discover I'm not able even to pray or do tonglen or have just empathy, then forget about it. So I have to work first on my mind.
So you kind of say, this is where I'm at right now, and you give yourself some empathy?
Naya, I'm really checking seriously in what I actually really can do. And maybe I have just a good will thinking, and but my ability to just do a little bit in my mind, just as developing compassion, is lacking already. And so there's a total gap between what is within myself and what I want to do.
Yeah. But that's not necessarily laziness. Okay, that is, you know, you can only do what you can do, and you have to accept that. But here the question is, what happens when we're lazy and we make excuses for that? So yeah, differentiate the two things in your mind.
I try to ask myself, is this the habit that I want to create? In terms of, do I want to be this person that, you know, if I do this once, it's creating the habit to continue into the future of saying no to something or not helping when I could, or is this the pattern that I want to give energy to? And asking, how has that worked out in the past? And to try and motivate myself that, you know, this small thing that I could help with or do is putting me in the direction that I want to go in, just to try and rouse my enthusiasm.
Does it work?
Well, if I do it sincerely, if it's not, if I honestly check in, like, you know, I want to be the kind of person that helps out when others ask, or I want to be this kind of person that does this, then, and it touches me, then yes. If it's kind of, if I go into a you should, not really.
Okay, yeah. If you do shoulds, doesn't work. But you have to really get in touch with what you want inside.
When I'm stuck like that, then there is doubt going, and then I try and get some clarity of that laziness. What is it? What is that? Is it the despondency? Is it the laziness of there's something more attractive that I want to be doing? And am I attached to the idea of helping? And, you know, so there's when it's a mess, it's messy. And then I don't really know what the mind is you know, trip up about.
Yeah.
Then it's difficult to get out of that mess. But if there is some clarity on what is the, maybe there's multiple afflictions going, but what is the main one that is pulling all these, then if I get that kind of clarity, usually I know how to move. And then before I get to that stage, a lot of time I put it on the altar for the Buddha, like beyond my pay grade, please. kind of. So then that creates some space for me.
Okay. So that's, in the last part you said, it's kind of like what Venerable Jhampa said, you make prayers, you know, you put it on the altar, you make prayers, you, you do that. Yeah, sometimes you put it on the altar and it accumulates a lot of dust. But what you said before is what you start to do is you look at what kind of laziness it is and what kind of afflictions are interrupting you. And then when you can see that clearly, then you know which antidote to apply. And then when you know which antidote to apply, then you have a better chance of success. Sometimes it's, oh, well, I really don't feel like getting out of this chair. And then, you know, that one's you can overcome. Yeah, I'll get out of my chair. But then other times it's like the mind is saying, forget it. Forget it. No. Yeah. Yeah, we know. I think all of us have that mind. Yeah. It just depends when it gets touched. Don't all of you have a mind where you just put your feet down, lock your knees, and say, no, forget it, no. Yeah. Everybody have that mind? Yeah. And we know. We all have it because we've all seen it in each other at one time or another, haven't we? Yeah. So what we want to do is minimize that mind. Yeah. Because it It really can be a nuisance. Yeah.
When I have laziness, often it's a poor quality view. Like, I can't do it. What I do doesn't matter, you know.
Okay.
I'm just little old me. I don't have any ability to make people happy. Forget it, you know. Okay. Somebody else can do it.
So if you practice like she was saying, then you identify, oh, that's the laziness of discouragement. Yeah. Then what's the antidote to the laziness of discouragement? What do you think about? Yeah, what about the Buddha?
We help so many people.
Yeah. There's also another part of the Buddha that's very important to remember when we're discouraged.
Buddha nature.
Buddha nature. Once like us. And that the Buddha was once like us. So it is possible to pull ourselves out of that. And we do have the Buddha nature and the ability to do that. Yeah. So for some people, it's that one that's the big laziness. Other people say, oh yeah, I'm confident I can become a Buddha.
Tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah, right now I'm really tired, you know, and I've worked hard. I need some chocolate. Actually, we haven't worked hard, but we say we need chocolate anyway. Yeah?
For me, the first two, the happiness of just this life is totally like, I'm permeated, it's my mind.
Uh-huh.
So the Mahayana laziness, you know, Astamanyana,
uh-huh.
And the one of the busyness, changing the schedule, changing people's lives, getting President Trump to sort of straighten up his act. It's all about my level of comfort.
Yeah.
Well, you know, no conflict, no displeasure, no hardship.
Yeah.
So the happiness of this life, I've never been able to wrap my mind around that because it's just so pervasive, but this is helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this life appears so real, doesn't it? So it's very difficult to think beyond it, but we've got to start to stretch our mind to think beyond it. I mean, we think of old age and we want to prepare for our old age. People are sometimes fanatic about that. You know, have to save so much money, have to arrange this and that for, and you're not even sure that you'll live that long to enjoy it. Yeah. Yet we spend a lot of time planning for it and go to great effort to collect all the, you know, cooperative conditions so that we'll have a good old age. And maybe we don't even live that long. But future life, which is definite, that's, you know, later. Mañana. Okay, so that's verse 15. So verse 16, although today I am healthy, well-nourished, and unafflicted, life is momentary and deceptive. The body is like an object on loan, but for a minute. Okay, so here's one of the antidotes, you know, the previous one, thinking about the four Mahayana wheels. You know, that remembering the good circumstances that we have is very important. And if we don't use that circumstance, those circumstances, it'll be very difficult to have them again. And then verse 16 continues along that. Okay, today I'm healthy. Yeah. How much do we just take our health for granted? And how much do we really appreciate, oh, today I'm healthy. You know, I realized this when my hip and my leg start acting up and all of a sudden I can't walk so well. And it's like, wow, I went through so many years just walking, 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 never appreciating the fact that I could walk without pain. Yeah. And then it was like, now I appreciate it, but I don't have it anymore. You know, now I'm walking with a lot of pain. Okay, well nourished. So we are well nourished now. But, you know, many people in this country were well nourished a few months ago. And now with, you know, COVID and the economy going down, those people are waiting in lines at food banks. And they're not well nourished anymore. You know, and here's where we see the incredible fortune we have and the amazing kindness of the people who support us. Yeah, because by any other accounts, we should be in those food lines too. Yeah. It's really by other people's kindness that we aren't. And right now we're unafflicted. Well, at least this moment, we don't have a really strong affliction in the mind. At least this moment, okay? So I can try and do something good with my mind. But that moment of having an unafflicted mind, you know, that one is not going to necessarily last so long or occur so often, okay? So while our mind is, you know, relatively open and stable, and we're not ranting about one thing or another, this is the time to really practice as we can. So life is momentary and deceptive. Everything appears permanent, but it isn't. Everything appears attractive, but it isn't. Okay. And this body is like something that's on loan to us. Yeah, we have so much attachment to this body that we can't imagine being separated from it, you know? And sometimes we even say, this is me, you know? This is mine, this is my most precious possession. I can sacrifice everything else, but I'm not gonna give up my body and give up my life. Yeah, but we have to at some time or another. Definitely. Yeah, no exceptions. So to see, you know, okay, this body and this precious human life in particular that I have on the basis of this body is very rare and it doesn't last for so long. And very quickly it ends. When I first met the Dharma, you know, the meditation on death was really quite, really affected me. And I started making a list of the people that I knew who had died. So, of course, I was like 24 at the time. And, you know, okay, by 24, all my grandparents had died. No. Only three of them had died. One grandmother was still alive, you know? But, you know, okay, one guy I went out to high school with, I heard about something, but I didn't personally know so many people who had died. And then you just keep your list and you keep being aware and adding to it every time somebody who you know personally dies. And it's amazing how that list grows and how some of the people on that list are the younger than we are and how some of those people were very healthy before they died. Yeah. And then it really begins to affect us much more. That we, you know, this body is on loan. We have it temporarily. And then, just like in the case of these other people, it disappears. Yeah. And now, especially, you know, if you follow the news and you read about the COVID deaths, and, you know, young people, young people get COVID-19 and young people can die from it, contrary to what some other people say. Yeah, but they do. And many people younger than us who were healthy before, no pre-existing conditions, get the virus and then they die. Or they get the virus and they recover, but they're finding that so many people have ongoing symptoms and ongoing effects of having had the virus. And we don't even know how this virus is going to affect people in 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Yeah? And it could affect people's health for a long, long time. So yeah, our lives, our bodies are on loan. Our health is, lasts only a short time. Okay. So there's time for maybe one or two questions.
Someone online asks, it seems that by following the Bodhisattva's way, we benefit others and as a byproduct end up benefiting ourselves with positive karma, allowing us to do even more for other sentient beings. This seems like a virtuous cycle. Is this a correct interpretation?
Yeah. Okay, through bodhicitta, we accomplish the purpose of others and we accomplish our own purpose. Mm-hmm. So it's win-win.
And someone else asks, could you please talk about how cultivating bodhicitta doesn't mean to accept everything and trust everyone, even if we have red flags, so to avoid conflict, and so in that way we don't cause harm?
Could you reword that for me?
Yeah. She's asking for you to talk about how cultivating bodhicitta doesn't mean that we're just a doormat, that we just trust everyone even if we see red flags, mm-hmm. or we have to accept anything from anyone.
Yeah. Well, this comes back to developing our own wisdom. And if we develop our wisdom, if we see red flags, then we know that we have to pay attention and we have to critically assess the situation and make wise decisions. Okay? So being compassionate doesn't cancel out being wise. Okay? We need to be wise and compassionate. Yeah, they go together. So it's not Mickey Mouse compassion. And this is a misunderstanding that many people have. Oh, compassionate. Yeah, I just give away everything. I just do what everybody wants. You know, that's Mickey Mouse compassion. Yeah, I mean, you see if you can find it said anywhere that compassion means giving up wisdom. See if you can find it anywhere in any religious text, in any legal text, in any philosophical text, in any scientific text, in anywhere at all. See if you can find that somebody's saying compassion means you give up wisdom. Okay. The only where that is found is in our wrong conception mind. Yeah. Our wrong conception mind that misinterprets things. Okay. Now somebody might say, but didn't Jesus do that? He just accepted he was going to be crucified and used it for the benefit of sentient beings. So he just let himself be a doormat. Do you think Jesus was some stupid guy who just said, I'm going to let myself be a doormat? No, he wasn't some stupid person. So there was a reason for what he did. Many people may misinterpret the reason. Okay. But he had some reason, and we may not fully understand his reason. But it definitely wasn't, I'm going to let people walk all over me. But then you say, but he said, when someone hits you, turn the other cheek. Yeah? So doesn't that mean becoming a doormat? Whatever somebody does, I just turn my other cheek and say, okay, beat me up here too. Isn't that what he meant? I don't think that's what he meant. Again, he was not stupid. Some of his followers may not have understood him so correctly. But he himself was not stupid. Yeah. I mean, he definitely had values, and he stuck up for his values. And he made it very clear when something was unacceptable, didn't he? You know, with the, what is it, the money lenders in the temple. He didn't just say, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, sure, that's not so good, but, you know, I'll turn the other cheek and maybe I'll do it too. You know, he didn't do that. He called people out on something that was wrong. Okay, so it's our wrong conception mind that doesn't understand what holy beings do.